Number 5A.
Now, I want to try if I can put the various things we have been discussing a little bit together with St. John's introductory prologue about the Logos. So what I will do, I first quickly read that prologue. There are only few verses, and then I go back to the main point, and we will try to see what is so different with St. John compared with the other gospel writers. So I just read quickly what he says. He's, you know, that he is in the four, where Christ, Christianity, and science, that he starts out and gives that like a prologue or as a motto to for the whole gospel. He says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God," the Word, the statement. Then you have the expression of that Word, the manifestation of that Word as the Christ. All things were made by Him, by that Logos, and without Him was not anything made that was made. So you have the clear sense of manifestation, creation and manifestation. The Christ is always that which manifests the Word of God. Then you come to Christianity. Christianity is always the outcome of that Christ, and in the center, in the focal point, is always man and the universe. And here you have it too. In Him, in that Logos, in Him was life, and the life was the light of man. So he brings it right down to man, to the focal point of Christianity. And then the fourth one, which is a little bit in the negative for his time, because he didn't know yet science and health. So he said, "And the light shines in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not." I have also said that the Greek version is that the darkness overpowered or overcame it not, had no power against it. It's a very good translation. So we had those four stages. First, the Word is God. Then the manifestation of the Word, that the Word has a manifestation, that it does express itself. And third, it expresses itself in the world, in man and the universe. And third, that is all a question of understanding, of a light that shines. And it's up to us if within us is darkness or misunderstanding or ignorance. If it's ignorance within us, then we cannot comprehend it, then we cannot see it. Okay, that's just the thing. Now, there are various enormously interesting points in it. I start again with the first sentence he had in the Word. In the beginning was the Word. The Greek says, in principle, there was the Logos. The beginning is a translation that does not quite accord to the Greek original, just as we have in Science and Health, where Mrs. Eddy explains the first verse of Genesis. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth, and she said there is no beginning. Beginning means that God was the only. The Latin and the Italian version says in principio, in principle, instead of in the beginning, in its principle, was the Logos. So we don't have any sense of a beginning. This is translation, and the translation is not quite correct. So the principle is that there is the Logos. That's what he says. And that Logos is really what we call God, and it was really God. So what does he say? He says, look here, you have a sense of God, and all through the Bible people have had a sense of God, and they are talking about God. It was either Elohim or it was Jehovah or it was El Shaddai, or any other denomination of God. And he says, look here, this God, what you call God, is actually a Logos. It's actually the Logos. And that's the principle. The Logos is your principle. Now, today we don't know any more by sure what the Logos meant at that time. The Logos was a term that was coined by Heraclitus around about 500 BC and has been used all through those 500 years, especially then in Ephesus where John lived. And Ephesus was a center of understanding, a center of learning, so to say, an intellectual center. And John, who was writing from Ephesus, was using that term. Therefore, we should know a little bit more what that term implies. And so when one consults various Bible dictionaries and other sources and looks up what Logos means, every book gives you another definition. It's not such a clear-cut term that you can define just exactly what it meant, because also these people had to go back to the writings of Heraclitus and had to find out what he really meant by it, and so we get various definitions. That really doesn't matter so much as long as we get the atmosphere of it, so to say, the sense of it, and that sense of it comes through practically as the same whatever dictionary we take up. For instance, one definition, which is a long one, but which gives quite a good insight, I read it, you don't need to write it down, I stress the main point in it, and that's what is necessary. That says, the Logos is the universal, rational. You can see the logic in it. That logic comes from the Logos. It's universally rational, orderly, even order is in it, organizing principle. So the, just as it says, as a principle we had the Logos. That's how John begins. So it is, the Logos is a principle that is universal, that is rational, that is orderly, that is organizing, self-organizing. It is, it goes on, the pervading cosmic intelligence. That's another point, that principle is not blind. You see, the principle of matter is blind. The principle of physics is blind. Principle of chemistry is blind. But the principle of the Logos is not blind. It's intelligent. It's the pervading cosmic intelligence. It has an idea, it has a definite idea, that created the universe and operates all things in it, including man's individual and collective destiny. It's quite a big thing that it is therefore that intelligence which determines even the destiny. You see, it has an aim, it's teleological or telefinalistic, the way you like to have it. It is driving towards a great aim, towards a great purpose, and has a great meaning in it. Can you see the wonderful difference between the definition of science and the Logos? Science is hostile to man. Science is hostile to man. The Logos is not hostile to man. Science doesn't care about man. Science is hostile to life. It kills life or it brings forth life. Doesn't matter, one or the other. It's hostile to life. Science as we have it in the world has no, makes no sense, has no purpose. Is that something worthwhile which we adore? We adore the sciences, and yet they are hostile to man, they are hostile to life. They make no sense for you, for one's life. They have no purpose in it. Is that something to be desired? The more one thinks about the definition of ordinary science, one thinks, why on earth are we really worshipping science? It's not worthwhile to be worshipped. And therefore, there are today more and more philosophers in science that feel that the greatest catastrophe that happened to mankind is the last 300 years when we were worshipping science. And we do not know yet, everybody does not know yet, if science will really throw us down the abyss. We don't know yet. It can easily be. It can easily be so. So we worship something that is not worthwhile being worshipped. Whereas John began to see there is something, a principle that is more than a dead principle, more than a hostile principle to man, namely the Logos. That is an intelligence that has a purpose in itself and guides towards that purpose. It's quite a terrific sense. Can you see that somehow it comes very near to what we would call the Christ science? That science which has a Christ, and the Christ is always a Christ idea, is always something in view which is saving, helping, which is always bringing something to fulfillment that is satisfactory. And so the Logos has within itself that tonality. I asked a student of mine who is a professor for Greek, and I said to him, could you give me a definition of Logos? And so he sent me one, which he has worked out through the going back through the original use of the Logos. And this is what he says. He says it's the eternal, unchangeable, cosmic law, which is the primeval principle. You see, again, it's not the beginning, it's a principle. A primeval principle of the whole universe. So it's not the beginning that is being shown here, but the principle of the whole universe. The one intelligence, he says, again intelligence, manifesting itself. Wonderful. Every other science you have to apply. The Logos applies itself. It manifests itself. Can't help but to be self-organizing, self-regulating, self-expressing, self-evolving. Can't help to do that. One intelligence manifesting itself in an understandable way. Again, we can see the isomorphy between the Logos and our understanding. That it is not something that is up on cloud nine, but that is something that can be translated right down to our human understanding and finds in our human understanding the absolute clear reflection of being. That is the two definitions that I wanted to show you, because it gives us a sense of what? And that is the point that suddenly dawned on me when I was considering John. If one goes back in the Bible always, when it wants to show what creation is, always shows a creator God. You take Genesis, very first term is, in the beginning God created. So what is right away introduced to our consciousness is that God is a creator. And we are, so to say, in line with that sense. We have been brought up with that sense. That we always ask for the beginning. That we always ask for the cause. That we always ask for the creator. From where did it come? What is the cause of this and that and the other? We always ask about the cause, about the creator, the producer, who did it. And so the beginning of the Bible has a God creator. And if you go further and further in the Bible, where did things come from? Well, they came from Abraham. Abraham is our father. Well, they came from Jacob. Jacob is our father. Well, and so on and so on and so on. And if we come to the Gospels, there again, everyone starts with a beginning. Matthew starts with Abraham as the beginning. Marcus starts with God as the beginning. Then Luke starts with Adam as the beginning. And then suddenly comes that pure thinker, John, and he says, I don't start with the beginning. I don't start with a creator God. What does it mean? It means for our consciousness that the time has come where we should get rid of that old traditional sense always to ask for a cause. What is the cause? If we start with a cause, we start with a finite, can you say a finite, instead of the infinite, huh? Something finite, because a cause is at the beginning somewhere. Huh? And if something has a beginning, it has an end. Are we happy with that? That everything that starts out has an end. I don't like it personally. I would rather like something that looks like a circle that has no beginning and no end, and yet is something, and still is evolving, and still is evolving, but it has no beginning and no end. And John began to see that. So he started out with the Logos as a principle that is. And you can call it God if you like it, you don't need to, but that is what he saw as. Now one has to be careful, because terms are always not quite inadequate. That is what he saw first, though first is also always a sense of beginning. Can you see what we learned from it? And I want to show you this afterwards in a more enlarged way. That John said to himself, being has always been being. It has not had a beginning. It has only been a principle. There's always been a principle, and not only just a dead dot of principle, but really a living principle, an intelligent principle, a principle that has within itself a purpose, that has within itself also the guiding intelligence to bring everything to the fulfillment of that purpose. It is a principle that has within itself meaning universally, collectively and individually. This is really a principle that we could adore and worship. And only afterwards, when it comes to the Christ, he begins to say that all things were made by that word. Now comes the creative sense in it. So the creative sense comes second, no more first. All through the Bible, the God creator was first. John brings in that being is the first, if we can call it first. But start out with being and not with creating. Do you see the difference in our life? Instead of constantly going through life and asking, what is the cause, where did it come from, where did it start out, what can be blamed as a cause, and so on, that we start out with a sense that everything is already at the point of fulfillment. There is no need for a creator. And that gives us a clue why Mrs. Eddy, at the end of the sixth day of creation, where she ends up creation, because the seventh day of creation is not the day of creation, because nothing has been created in the seventh day, but at the end of the sixth day is truth and love. She speaks about that creation is the, oh, how can I forget my, it's the outgrowth, huh? It's the outgrowth of its infinite self-containment, she says, huh? A paradox. You cannot have an infinite self-containment and then an outgrowth that goes outward, and it will not be self-contained. So the great teachings always can only be taught through paradoxes. What he meant is this, what he has here in these two points of the Word and the Christ, that there is that infinite self-containment. There is no beginning, no end. It's a circle. Everything is included. And yet, in that infinite self-inclusion, there is constantly something happening. And this within happening is creation, is called creation. But it is not so that God created and that creation went outside, and that somewhere there is a universe including man, and that is outside the creator. So that creator and creation is one and is within itself. And that gives a completely different attitude for us to approach a problem and to see, well, the situation is already at the point of solution. Every situation is already solved because it is within the logos that contains everything. And therefore, the second step is that we just can let that infinite self-containment express itself. And we don't have to do it ourselves. We are just in that wonderful attitude where we just rest within ourselves and just can see that infinite self-containment is not something static, but something dynamic. Therefore, that logos is self-organizing and therefore is self-expressing and therefore expresses itself by its own power, by its own authority. Yes, I feel this is a big point because John is the only one who reasons that way. And it's that standpoint that he carries then right through the gospel, that he doesn't speak about creation anymore in the way of bringing forth something, but that it is always that which is embosomed within itself. Now, before I go further to the third point, I want to divert for a moment and bring in a completely different subject. But at the end of that subject, you will see that I come back to the logos. We have been talking a lot about evolution and the evolution of the universe, etc. And what I want to show you or just tell you quickly is a paper that I read just a few weeks ago that has come out from the director of the world's biggest accelerator that is in Geneva. You know that accelerator they build, that is the biggest one, and they hope to find out more about the Big Bang, about what happened. They already think that they can reconstruct what happened in the first millionth second after the Big Bang. They couldn't come closer up to now. But that doesn't matter. I only want to show that I give you present you something that I, as a layman, don't understand, but I can see the impact of it, and therefore I quote him in the translation into English and just pinpointing it about what he says as his latest discovery in the investigation of matter or of evolution. So I go to my notes and just... I don't think that you have to understand it. That's not necessary. It's just enough to see what happens in the world today. He is asking, what are the ordering principles of the universe? The logos. What is the ordering principle of the universe? And he can see that he has to do with three different problems. The question, what is matter? The question, what is life in matter? The question, what is consciousness in matter? These are the three great departments that we are dealing with: a material universe, then a life universe, and a conscious universe. He naturally can see that all these three depend on understanding what is matter. If life in matter, you must understand what is matter. Consciousness in matter, you must understand what is matter. So he gives a short history, which we know all. It shows that Democritus, the Greek, was the very first one who was asking what is the smallest indivisible part in the world. The atom. Atom means no more divisible. And so since then, the physicists were asking for it. After many, many hundreds of years after Democritus, they first found out that the building blocks of the universe are molecules. Then you know that they found out that molecules are composed of atoms. Then they found out the atom is composed of a nucleus and of electrons. Then afterwards they found out still tinier building blocks, namely that the atom nucleus is a compound of protons and neutrons. Then they found out that there is even 1,000 times smaller building block, namely that there are two families of 6 leptons and 6 quarks that are still smaller. So you can see that I show you the line of analysis from hard boiled matter down to always smaller and smaller building blocks.